This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Worcester is up in arms over a new charter school. In a split vote, the State Board of Elementary and Secondary Education has approved the school's application over objections from the Worcester School Committee and local elected leaders. WBUR education reporter Max Larkin joins us from the newsroom to tell us more about it. Welcome back, Max.
Thanks for having me back.
All right, let's start. Just tell us about the school. What is the school that's been approved?
It's called the Worcester Cultural Academy, so it's going to be a K-4 school to start with this coming August. It'll serve up to 360 students at full capacity and run K-8. But then that's small compared to the size of the Worcester School District, about 1.5% of the size. So the goal, Tiziana, is to bring students out of the classroom and into the world of museums, parks, public art, et cetera, hence the name Worcester Cultural Academy. And the school will be run by an education management nonprofit based in New York and, significantly, by current and former staff of the Old Sturbridge Village Museum and Charter School.
Now, you say significantly because that's part of the source of the pushback here, right?
Indeed, yeah. You've got people concerned that this school fits a bit awkwardly and unclearly into this constellation of the Old Sturbridge Village Museum, the Old Sturbridge Village Academy, and that those ties need to be basically sorted out before we should have gone ahead with this.
So the Old Sturbridge Village, that's like a community and a museum. They already have a charter school, the Old Sturbridge Village Academy?
They do, and they've run it since 2017, about 360 students there already.
Okay, and so then they would also be partially running this new charter school.
Yeah, and you had in an annual report there, President Jim Donahue calling this an expansion of the academic educational offerings of Old Sturbridge Village. So they're not exactly hiding the tie.
Okay, and that tie, so this is where this gets interesting, right? Because now you have an institution that has a different mission, a different operating budget, different employees, but may also run a charter school that basically makes money for them.
Yeah. So I think we can go to the morning of the vote here. So you have nearly every elected official representing Worcester, mayor, superintendent, school committee, city council, the state delegation coming out and saying, we do not want this. And the reason that they do not want this is because charter schools are funded out of district budgets, out of a reimbursement. They said at full capacity, this thing will take $7 million per year to educate a pretty small contingent of students out of Worcester's educational budget, which historically has been tight. And what they pointed to was in an annual report, Donahue saying this school will be a source of, quote, reliable revenue for the museum, which feels like we're taking from the taxpayers to give ultimately to a private institution and not even one that is a school per se.
And are there proponents who say, no, this is a good thing?
Yeah, there certainly are. There wasn't a lot of organic parent presence at the final confirming vote last week, but you did have people who work for the school and the museum saying, listen, Worcester schools are among the lowest 10% in terms of the state's lowest 10% in terms of their standardized test performance. And they would say parents deserve options and this school will be a good option. It'll be experiential, project-based learning. It'll be small class sizes. You like those things, right? And so there's an argument still being had that this school represents a vital contribution to Worcester.
So I'm zooming in on what you said, Max. You said, let's go to the morning of the vote. And now you're talking about all these people who represent Worcester in various official capacities who are saying, don't do it, don't do it. And yet you have a state board of elementary and secondary education that does it anyway. So how does that happen? And what did we hear? My understanding is it was a split vote from the board.
Yeah, it was a split vote. You have to consider that this board was put together by Charlie Baker, who was, you know, avowedly in favor of charter schools. His Secretary of Education, Jim Pizer, huge fan of charter schools. And so you had a group of people on this board that still see charter schools as delivering on a promise to give rigorous education, experiments in education, expanding the marketplace and giving options to parents. And then you also have the memory of the state having voted 62% against charter schools just 7 years ago.
This is that ballot question that would have increased the cap back in 2016 and failed, right?
Precisely. And I think you hear that tension where people, you know, the big argument for opponents of that question, Tiziana, was these schools take from our public schools, which have to serve all students, and lavish those funds on much smaller communities of students. And so you hear the big debate, the unmade-up mind of the state of Massachusetts on what these schools do and what they offer.
We're talking with WBUR education reporter Max Larkin about a controversy around a new charter school that's been approved for Worcester by a state board over objections from many of the officials in Worcester. So, Max, two things you said there that I want to pull out. Let's pull out the first one. This sort of serves a smaller population, right? So we're talking 360 students, roughly, when it's at full capacity at a price tag of $7 million. And my understanding is one of the concerns has been whether or not Old Sturbridge and its other charter school have demonstrated the ability to really work with students who are English language learners, which is a big percentage of Worcester students. Is that right?
Yeah, they're leading the state. There are large and growing enclaves of refugee and immigrant communities, a lot from the Near East in Worcester. They make up 30%. English learners make up 30% of the students in Worcester. That's among the top communities in the state. And you have a serious concern that this kind of, you know, Old Sturbridge Village has a lot to offer, but it hasn't traditionally been sort of this cosmopolitan center, right? It's a living museum about 19th century New England.
Right.
And yeah, you have real concern, and DESE themselves, which recommended the enactment of the grant of this charter, did note that the school didn't go as far as it might have done to show that it knows how to support that particular community of students. So with like dual language classes, you know, native language counseling, et cetera.
So this now raises a meta issue, Max, about whether or not the system that we have in place in the state, you said, you know, this is a Baker board, pro-charter board, we have a new administration. Any chance things might change?
Well, I think we hear it beginning to change. So there were four no votes. You had parent member Marianne Stewart, union member Darlene Lombos, and a student member who has a vote on the state board saying, we're not here to create financial lifeboats for museums. Eric Planky from Westford said that. But the fourth no vote came from the new Secretary of Education, Patrick Tutwiler, who was the former superintendent of the Lynn Public Schools. And I think it's worth listening to what he has to say.
I believe that all public schools, charter or district, must provide equal access to all students. Therefore, based on what is proposed, I do not believe that this community is best served by this particular school. It needs to be said that this decision, my decision, should not signal a position on future charter applications. Upon a recommendation from the commissioner, I'll weigh each application on its merits.
So as I said, Tiziana, this was a big change in sort of education ideology, governor to governor. You have in Healy someone who is maybe skeptical of the hugely important role that the MCAS plays in education, accountability determinations for school districts, much closer to the teachers' unions, et cetera. You hear Tutwiler saying, I don't think this school is equipped to serve the community we're putting it in, but at the same time, I'm not trying to be knee-jerk, ideological about those things. So if you're applying for a charter next year, don't worry about it. I'm going to look at it on the merits.
So in the last minute or so that we have, Max, what happens now? Is it just a done deal? The charter school goes forward? That's it?
Well, the state in some ways is the final arbiter of these things. And yeah, now this school is slated to open its doors in August. But Worcester, which so clearly registered its discontent, isn't done fighting. They voted the night before this state vote to refer the matter of the ties to the museum to the state inspector general, the ethics commission. So there's a goal to keep pushing and maybe block this thing or at least change its terms a little bit.
On other grounds at the state level, despite what the DESE board voted.
Precisely so.
And what will you watch for?
I think it has been, I think, 5 years since a new charter was granted. There was a sense that there was exhaustion with the issue after that 2016 contentious, really expensive campaign. And I think we're going to have to watch to see how this school settles in this super diverse community that has made it pretty clear they do not want it.
Fascinating. WBUR education reporter Max Larkin, thanks for running it down for us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Did you know that every Charleston Chew candy bar in the world is made in Cambridge? Let me back up. In the 1800s, there was a manufacturing stretch in Cambridge. It was over a mile long, known as Confectioner's Row. That's right, candy factories. On WBUR's podcast Last Scene, senior reporter Andrea Shea and podcast producer Nora Sachs dug into the history behind the booming candy industry in our own backyard. Today, we bring you part one of that Last Scene episode, Unwrapping the Lost History of Confectioner's Row.
When you were a kid, did you have a favorite candy? If you close your eyes, can you feel it melting on your tongue or cracking between your teeth? Well, like a lot of kids in the 70s and 80s, Andrea Shea used to freeze long, chocolate-covered Charleston chews, and she'd smack them on the counter into bite-sized pieces. So for a little nostalgia, we're going to do it together.
Okay, so you just take the bar, you hold it in your hand, and you just...
Wow, let me try. Oh, that feels good.
And you can keep doing it until it smacks into a whole bunch of little pieces.
Is this so it doesn't, like, crack your teeth?
It was a commercial. Get a whack, get a Piggy snack. You love your chewy, fun to do it, Charleston. A real chewy chew. Everyone was doing it. You know, you'd go to the penny candy store and buy Charleston chews, ride your bike over, fill your paper bag and come home, stick it in the freezer and...
Smack away.
Smack away.
I love it.
And actually, they called it the Charleston crack.
Charleston crack. I'm going to put that in my pocket. Well, Andrea, a few years back, you learned something that totally blew your mind, that every single Charleston chew in the entire world is made in Cambridge, Massachusetts, not far from where you live.
Right. Some reporter I am. I have driven by that old building so many times, and I had no idea it was a candy factory.
And it turns out that factory is the last vestige of a major 20th century candy hub known as Confectioner's Row.
Right. So Confectioner's Row was this place that for decades, dozens of companies were there, and they concocted every sweet imaginable. There's gum, there's hard candy, chocolate. It was said that the aromas of these sweets filled the air with these intoxicating smells of these iconic brands, including the Necco wafer and the Charleston Chew.
And Andrea, you wanted to know what happened to this place, Confectioner's Row.
Right. For what at this point feels like forever, I was just so curious about why this booming hub disappeared and whether there were any little pieces of it left.
Welcome to Last Scene, our show about people, places, and things that have gone missing. Coming at you from WBUR, Boston's NPR station. I'm Nora Sachs. Today, with WBUR senior arts and culture reporter Andrea Shea, we invite you to explore Lost Confectioner's Row.
$37 billion. That's how much money Americans spent on their sweet tooths in 2021. Most of that candy was manufactured in places like Illinois and Pennsylvania, think Hershey. But the American candy industry was actually born in Boston. Starting in the 1800s, candy making boomed across the Charles River in Cambridge, along a 1 to 2 mile stretch with a tantalizing name, Confectioner's Row. There's almost no evidence of it now. Even if you scoured the neighborhood, almost any sign of that booming industry has gone missing. There's stuff online about it, but I wanted to know more. Then I found someone who got to experience the tail end of this mythic place.
Out of the side door of the Necco factory, they had a little store, and it was only open, I think it was on Thursday, and only for employees where they could go and buy candy cheap.
When Susan Benjamin was a young hippie in the 70s, she loved those chalky, multicolored Necco wafers and made pilgrimages to the factory.
And I'm going to tell you, that smell was there. It just permeated.
That aroma of gobs of candy being made 24/7 is like a holy grail for Susan. I've never met anyone as obsessed with the idea of candy's power. It seems so personal.
So when I was young, I was ill, I was out of school, I was bullied, and my life was kind of a misery.
Susan found comfort in the candy aisles at pharmacies and penny candy stores. She also used her stash to pay off the bullies.
I could offer them candy, and they would take it. And for that time, if that time only, it was okay.
Candy also runs in Susan's family. Her great aunt, who emigrated from Eastern Europe, found a job in Cambridge along Confectioner's Row. She was an enrober who Susan says was super proud of how she got good at putting little swirls on top of chocolates. Over time, Susan turned her obsession with candy into a pretty unique job, candy historian.
I mean, it was the perfect researcher's universe because hardly anyone was doing it. And the stories were cool. They were about immigrants. They were about enslavement. They were about women in the kitchen and women in the workplace. It was all there and ready for me to do the picking, which gave me also a sense of purpose.
These days, Susan, who's 65, channels that purpose into writing books, lecturing, and running a history-based candy store in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. It's stocked with vintage brands and reproductions of candy that go back to before the Revolutionary War. Susan's also something of a media darling.
It's a love fest for sweets at True Treats in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia, the only historic candy store in the United States. Owner Susan Benjamin offers customers interesting tidbits.
Lucky for me, Susan is totally down to come back to Cambridge, in part because she wants to see the old Necco factory, where she used to get her weekly fix of wafers. Main Street, where Confectioner's Row used to be, is nothing like Susan remembers. This area has exploded into an international center of tech and medical research, where science has replaced sugar. Vaccine giants Moderna and Pfizer are here, and we're surrounded by shiny glass and steel skyscrapers.
So how does it make you feel to be walking around here and looking at all these buildings?
I know that there's some existential underpinning here, that here was this huge universe that went on for miles. So it kind of makes you think, wow, where did it go and how could it so completely vanish?
Susan bets the MIT students and scientists walking past us have no idea about this area's candy past. And she's right, at least according to Guillermo Hercules, an MIT lab worker who we stopped and asked about Confectioner's Row.
What I know about candy history here, I will tell you nothing.
I don't know nothing about candy history.
Well, here's some of that history. Back in its heyday, horse-drawn carriages and candy mongers lined Confectioner's Row. But before then, the country's first chocolate mill opened in Boston in 1765. Sugar, harvested by enslaved Africans in the Caribbean, flowed into the harbor and satisfied the colonists' cravings for sweets. Sugar might be demonized these days, but Susan says back then it was the backbone of medicines for stomach aches and sore throats. This is when Necco enters the story. In 1847, a pharmacist named Oliver Chase patented the first candy machine. He used it to slice thin Chase lozenges, then the Hub wafer.
And eventually what everybody knows and loves, the Necco wafer in the early 1900s.
Chase crossed the river to Cambridge, where land was cheap and other bootstrapping candy makers were setting up shop. He eventually merged with two other producers to form the New England Confectionery Company, a.k.a. Necco, and it became a national icon.
Necco was the first to box quality chocolate-covered peppermints for 5 cents. And then, of course, there are the famous wafers, which have been popular since before the turn of the century.
Necco used to be the country's oldest continuously operating candy company. Now, it's long gone from Cambridge. Its brands sold off to out-of-state companies. But the old building is a National Historic Landmark. That's where Susan and I head next. Susan knows from her research that the pharmaceutical giant Novartis took over the former Necco factory in 2004. But now that she's seeing it with her own eyes...
I can't even talk. I can't believe how upset I am. It's gone. We're right outside of the former Necco company that had always been a Necco factory. I mean, even when it closed, it was still a Necco factory. Now it looks like something else.
Show me the door that you used to go to, or where you think it used to be.
I don't know, because the first floor has all these windows.
Memory is a tricky thing, right? Susan is trying to piece together the pictures in her mind. She feels like a formative part of her past has been lost.
And there is no smell in the air at all.
No hint of sugar, caramel, chocolate. And there's something else that's different. The old cylindrical water tower on top of the building used to be painted to look like a giant colorful roll of Necco wafers. Now it wears the twisting strands of a double helix, that symbol of molecular biology and genetic research.
When you want to save humans from disease, ask science.
Susan isn't the only one mourning the loss of the neighborhood.
People had enormous affection for Necco. It was a local landmark.
Charles Sullivan is the head of the Cambridge Historical Commission. He remembers how the community rose up to save the mammoth rainbow-hued Necco roll on top of Novartis's building.
In people's imaginations, it had always been there, and it was something that they felt characterized Cambridge, and they wanted to hang on to it.
Charles oversaw Novartis's renovation of the Necco factory. His commission's office is filled with all kinds of vintage stuff from Cambridge's sugary past. Old photos, advertisements, boxes, and tins.
All right, I need to get my glasses. We don't have a lot of original records. Most of the companies had disappeared by the time we began collecting things.
Before you came to Cambridge, did you have any idea that Confectioner's Row existed?
No, not at all.
Charles joined the Historical Commission in 1974. He digs out some old musty city directories that list the names of companies along Confectioner's Row.
The industrial scene changed so quickly that these companies were always merging and splitting, and people were leaving and setting up their own shops. Some of them were just storefronts, and some of them were big industrial operations.
At the industry's peak, there were more than 60 candy companies in this part of Cambridge. They employed a lot of immigrants from Italy, the Balkans, the Azores, Eastern Europe. Susan believes jobs in candy uniquely offered them the promise of a new beginning.
There were people who had been traumatized by the potato famine if they were from Ireland, by pogroms if they were Jewish, and then, of course, many of the people who may have moved up from the South who have African-American descent. So you have people who were there not just to have a nice life, but to have a life at all.
Susan imagines what it would have been like to live and work on Confectioner's Row during its heyday.
You can smell, as generations could since then, including me, caramel and chocolate and vanilla, and it smelled so good.
It used to be said that depending on the day of the week, you would perceive different smells that would waft over the neighborhood. So it contributed to people's sense of place, as well as the sense of economic security as a source of many, many hundreds of jobs.
But a lot of those jobs were actually in rubber and soap factories. Charles suspects Susan imagines Cambridge smelled better than it actually did.
Human memory is malleable. And if you're a child growing up, the smell of candy is just irresistible. I mean, it probably imprints itself on your memory more than the smell of rendered animal fat, which can be really intense and nauseating.
Over time, traditional manufacturing left Cambridge, and Charles says the immigrants who worked in those factories followed. These days, Cambridge smells Well, like most cities, I guess. But if you know where to stand, and if the wind is right, you can still catch whiffs of the candy bars I used to freeze and smack into pieces.
There you go, to the penny candy store and buy Charleston Chews.
Remember we said the Charleston Chews were made by the sole survivor of Confectioner's Row? It's called Cambridge Brands, and it makes every single Charleston Chew on the planet. But how come nobody seems to know it's even here?
They're famously private. They have almost no public profile in Cambridge.
In all his decades at the Historical Commission, Charles had never interacted with Cambridge Brands. That changed a few years ago when the company wanted to expand its footprint and needed his help.
But before that, they were really unknowable.
Unknowable, like Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. Maybe you remember that movie's creepy character who, outside the mysterious building, warns,
"Nobody ever goes in. Nobody ever comes out."
Will Susan's candy industry cred help us get inside the last candy factory on Confectioner's Row?
Find out tomorrow when we bring you part two of the lost history of Confectioner's Row from the WBUR podcast, Last Scene. The New England Revolution opened their season on February 25th with a win against the Charlotte Football Club from North Carolina. Today, we bring you a conversation with one of their players, 24-year-old starting defender Henry Kessler. He joined us in Studio 2 for a chat before they left for preseason training. Henry has talked in previous interviews about his first memory of soccer as a very young boy whose skills caught the attention of a coach at one of his sister's rec league games. But I wanted to know, when was the first time he fell in love with the sport and he knew it was something he wanted to dedicate his life to?
I think it came a little later. I don't know if there's a specific moment, but I remember a specific time period when I definitely dedicated myself to the sport.
And what made you do that? And how old were you?
Yeah, I think I was, I want to say 12, 13. So that's when academy started for my age group. Now I think it's, they start even younger.
Like at two.
yeah, it seems like it. But no, so I think that, so I initially played for the Red Bull Academy, New York Red Bull Academy. So I grew up in New York and New York City FC didn't exist. So that was the team. And I kind of got to that level and I felt like, you know, it was a professional environment. And I kind of felt like that was when, you know, I really started dedicating myself to the sport, stopped playing other sports. You know, I really enjoyed playing basketball, tennis, other sports, and I stopped doing that. So kind of really focused on soccer. And I think it was falling in love with the grind. That sounds so cliche, but, you know, really loving the process of getting better and improving and being in an inspiring environment. So
there's two questions I want to ask you at once, yeah. And I got to sort of discipline myself. I'll pick one and then the other. So let's do the grind thing first.
Okay.
All right. Because that was 12 years ago.
Yeah.
Right? Has there ever been a moment in the last 12 years where you weren't in love with the grind?
No, not really. I think there are days where, like, you definitely don't want to do something. Like this morning, my trainers were like, okay, can you be in here at 8? And I'm usually in there at 8:30. And so I got half an hour less sleep, and I was like, oh, I really could.
I've heard you like your sleep.
I love my sleep. I was like, I really could use that extra half hour. So I wanted to stay in bed a little longer, but that's just one minor example of, you know, something that I wish I could do. But no, I would say I definitely enjoy improving. There hasn't been really a time when, you know, it's all worth it, but there are definitely little things that I miss.
All right, so now let's go back to that time when you were 12 or 13, mm-hmm. and you were in this professional environment and you're realizing, you know, I want to do this.
Yeah.
There are some, all right, well, A, let's just acknowledge that level of intensity and focus and self-awareness at that age is just extremely unusual, right? So that mm-hmm. puts you in some 0.0000% of kids anyway. But then a lot of kids would have in that moment think, I hope. But it sounds like you didn't think, I hope. You thought, I can.
Yeah.
And how does that happen for a 12-year-old?
I don't know. But I do agree with you. I think a lot of people were like, oh, if this opportunity presents itself. For me, it was always like, no, this is what I want to do. I'm going to do it. And it was more of a decision rather than kind of letting something happen to me. So I think I just kind of decided. and, you know, went after it, and here I am.
So I think I said to you already that my goals in this conversation are both to learn about you and to learn about the sport. I want to stay with you a little bit longer. In reading and preparing to talk to you, one of the things that has become a little bit legend about you already is that there was a period where you basically commuted round trip 5 hours a day to go to Connecticut to play with a team, right?
Yeah.
That's not funny. You're laughing about it, right? 5 hours a day for a teenager. Holy cow.
It's insane.
Yeah.
It's insane. So I'll back up a little bit. I think my commuting days really started around that age of 12, 13 when I joined the Red Bull Academy. So that's kind of like a specific moment in my life when I think things got more serious.
Yeah.
The teams that I played for prior, maybe more for fun, if you will. People were maybe less focused, didn't have the same ambition. And I feel like once I got to the Red Bull Academy, people had the same ambition, kind of this similar drive, that type of desire. So I started commuting to New Jersey because there were no academy teams really in New York. So took the L train to another subway to the PATH train to the light rail to get to practice. That was in Newark, New Jersey. And so I've kind of...
Alone,
myself, at 12. That seems old to me because then my younger brother was doing it at like 10, you know, so.
You were an old man at 12.
Right.
Nearly a teenager, for goodness sake.
So, there were definitely nights where I remember one specifically where my phone died and my mom was very concerned.
Yeah.
So like you said, I was still young and Newark's not the greatest place, to be honest. So she was worried, but like I got home, everything was fine, but she was upset. So,
you know, you just made half of Newark mad, right?
Yeah.
Let me give you a chance to fix that.
it's got a lot of great qualities too. There's some great restaurants, but
there you go.
You know,
but you were 12 year old alone.
Yeah. 12 year old alone. So my mom was concerned at times, and if I didn't text her periodic updates, she would be concerned. So when my phone died that night, she was like, I think I remember getting home, charging my phone, and she texted me, "Are you dead?"
Oh.
I'm like, oh, no. I'm like, this is like, and I didn't think it was anything, you know, but she,
okay,
those
as
texts,
a mom,
those
I
texts
can
meant,
tell you. Yeah.
Those texts meant a lot to her. So my commuting started then. After Red Bull, I played for a different team in Connecticut, which you mentioned was a 5 hour round trip commute. So I started similar, taking the subway, went to Grand Central, took the Metro North train to Bridgeport, Connecticut. And then one of my teammates would pick me up, another, I don't want to make Bridgeport sound bad, but it's a little rough. So a teammate would pick me up from the train station and then drive me to the field, practice, and then do the same thing on the way back. So it took me 2.5 hours each way. That was tough. It was difficult. You know, I was doing homework on the train, eating on the train, you know, but I got really productive. And sometimes now I'm like, Henry, how are you so productive? You know, like now I feel like the day just goes by and I haven't done a ton other than train. You
gotta
know,
get
and stuff.
Up an extra half an hour early.
Yeah, right. I'm complaining about half hour of sleep. So, I feel like things have changed a little bit, but I've always been commuting and it's...
Are you proud of that kid?
100%. Yeah, because I think a lot of people would have not chosen to do that, even though it was 100%, like, it was what I needed to do, really, if I wanted to, like, be a pro, which I did. So after the Red Bull Academy, it was like there was a kind of a gray area where I wasn't going to play. They kind of told me that after having played for every minute for 3 years, you know, it was seeming that I wasn't going to play, so I had to change teams. But they told me this in August, so all these teams were filled.
Okay, we're talking with Henry Kessler, who plays, he's a defender for the New England Revolution. Wait, there was a team that after 3 years, you're a professional soccer player,
yeah.
And there was a team that was like, nah, you're not going to play for us anymore.
Yeah.
How did, what?
Yeah, and the crazy part to me is that the guys that played over me are out of the sport.
Yeah.
That's not like they're sensational players, you
right.
know? So different coaches see different things.
So what do coaches see in you?
Right now or then?
Well, I'm assuming it's a trajectory, right?
Yeah, I mean, clearly they lacked foresight. The ones with Red Bull, but the ones now, I think they see. I would hope they see a guy that's passionate about the sport, that's eager to learn and get better every day, and you know, someone that's tough. So I think that's I hope that's what I the impression that I give.
Watching film of you, you look like you're having a lot of fun.
I do. I really enjoy it. Yeah. And, you know, some of my teammates make it even more enjoyable. I think the guy I play next to, Andrew Farrell, he enjoys it maybe even more than I do. You know, he seems like he's always laughing, always having fun. So I think that that helps me sometimes.
That's got to help
with
the grind.
For sure. Yeah. It's like, and I've been listening to some podcasts recently, Huberman Labs specifically, and there's a lot about enjoying the process and the neurological effects that take place during it too.
The chemicals that get
released. Dopamine, for example. Dopamine gets released when you're enjoying it. So rather than, oh, I hate this, let me just get it over with, like I'll have – the reward will be when I'm done. Mm-hmm. Like the reward is you doing it. So like that psychological kind of element is huge. So if you enjoy doing it, it becomes easier. You want to do it more. So all that's a factor.
Your team struggled a lot with injury last year.
Yeah.
Do you worry about your body? I mean, we've talked
for sure
about this grind. Do you worry that sooner or later your body's going to betray you and you're not going to be able to keep doing it?
Yeah. I mean, last year I struggled with injuries myself. I had several hamstring injuries. And hamstrings are reoccurring. I tell you what, the best advice I can give to avoid a hamstring injury is never get the first one. Because they're
okay then. Yeah, I thought you were going to say don't have hamstrings. So
no,
at least
yeah,
not
yeah.
that.
But no, it's a lot, and you know we have a lot of staff members that try to control our load, and they keep track of how much we're running, how fast we run, all of these things to try to prevent injuries, and they do a great job. But things happen. You hyperextend, whatever, you know, things happen. So that was a battle for our team last year and myself included. So hopefully this year we can kind of prevent that.
We had two things we wanted to learn from Henry Kessler, defender for the New England Revolution, his soccer history, and his thoughts on soccer today. Henry picked up that thread by telling us how to watch the game and how to appreciate what the players and the teams are doing.
I think the is how teams move. You know, I think that generally will give you an understanding. So like, I'll make an analogy to American football. It's very structured. So you see teams move 10 yards at a time, generally. Soccer is a little bit more fluid. So
just a little.
Yeah, yeah. So you get a better idea of like not only where the ball is, but where the team is. So if everyone's in one half, you know, generally that means the attacking team is in a favorable position and vice versa. So I would say look where the players are, not just where the ball is. That would be my first bit of advice. But you hit the nail on the head. What I don't understand, I enjoy less too. And yeah. I think there are nuances in every sport that, you know, I only understand in my sport, and I try to watch other sports and gather this stuff. But what you don't understand, I think you enjoy less. So
there was a moment as I was preparing to talk with you today. So I was looking at sort of, I was on YouTube and I'm looking at, you know, highlight reels and film mm-hmm. of you playing and that kind of thing. Two things that I noticed. One, not at all surprising, which is despite the fact that you're a defensive player for the New England Revolution, many of the highlights are when you've scored, right?
Okay.
And that's because everybody knows that that's success, right? We all know what it means when the ball goes in the net or through the goalposts or whatever that, you know. But the other thing was there was one video. It's from a 2019 game. You were still in college. And it is a compilation of all your plays in that game.
I think I've actually seen this one.
This is the one against Pacific.
It's yeah. 20,
right. Okay, so here's the thing. I'm watching the 7 minutes, right? And I know you're an elite player. So there are things I know I must be seeing that are amazing, that's excellence. But I don't know how to see it because I don't know what you're doing. So if somebody's watching you achieve excellence as a defender, what do they look for to see that excellence unfolding on the field? Do you understand my question?
I understand. It's generally really small things, so it's hard to it's harder for the average person to analyze a defender than an attacker. An attacker, you do something good, it's obvious.
Right.
A defender, you do something good, it's maybe not so obvious. But I tell my teammates this all the time. It's the little plays that make me so happy. So, for instance, like, oh, I made someone play a backwards pass. That's a W.
Somebody has to pass a ball behind them.
Exactly. So I'm defending a striker, attacker, winger, whoever, and they play the ball backwards towards their own net. That's a good play.
See, and I can look for that.
You can look for that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Give me a couple others.
Yeah, if I force someone backwards, even if I kick a ball out of bounds, if they're attacking and I kick it out, that might be a good clearance.
Why?
Just it. they can't score from the stands. You know,
you kind of get a re-hit.
Yeah. If the ball is in the stands, they can't score.
That's
why.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of a few. Oh, and if I'm on the ball, and I pass the ball forward, it could be a short pass, it could be a longer pass. If it's a forward completed pass, that's a good play.
Yeah.
Because I'm getting the ball closer to the opposition's net.
What is your favorite thing that you're good at?
I'm going to – two categories, attacking, defending. I'm going to go defending. I'm a defender. I take pride in that. I think I'm someone who's hard to play against. So I think if you asked opposing strikers, they'd be like, yeah, that guy's really annoying. You know, he's a pain. And I think that's probably what brings me the most joy is being a pain to other players.
And why are you a pain? Because you're in their way? Because you're stealing the ball a lot? Because you're trash talking? I mean, what's making you so annoying?
I think
happily annoying.
Yeah, right. I'm physical, so like there's a lot off the ball that happens that maybe the camera doesn't pick up, but like the ball's out of the play, push, you know, like shove, whatever. Get it kind of like
Henry.
There's always contact.
Yeah.
There's always contact. So, you know, stuff like that. Yeah.
All right. So a couple other things now. I feel like I've learned. I I'm going to go try this, right?
Okay.
You've given me some things to watch for. I'm going to go try this. And I'm actually, the first thing I'm going to do is go back to your 7 minutes and watch for these little things that you've just told me about. And I bet you I'll see all of them.
Great.
Right, in that 7 minutes. All right. So a couple of other things. I want to talk World Cup.
Yeah.
And I want to talk both what it must feel like to have the pinnacle of your sport coming home in 2026 and in your secret, deepest place of what you want. What is your dream about what happens for you in 2026?
So I'll answer the first part, which is the World Cup coming back to the U.S. You know, my parents, I don't think I was, what was it, 94?
Yeah.
When it was last in the U.S.?
I think that's right.
I wasn't alive. My parents told me they attended. Great, was great for the sport. It actually kind of created MLS 2 years later.
Major League Soccer?
Yeah. So it had an immense effect the first time it was here. I can't imagine the effect it'll have next time. So I know it's going to be in three countries, U.S., Canada, and Mexico. I think that's going to be great too, just, you know, get different venues. But if it created a league the last time it was here, I can't imagine what it'll do this time. So I'm really excited. I think it'll grow the sport even more, and I think the sport is continuing to grow here. And so I'm really excited for that. And then secondly, on a personal note, I hope I'm a part of it, obviously. I've only played for the U.S. twice, so hope to add to those appearances. I hope I'm starting, you know, the whole lot, everything you can imagine I'm hoping for. And I'm not just hoping, I'm also working towards.
So just for our listeners to get a sense of this, you were the overall number six draft pick in 2020.
Yeah.
And for those of you who don't know how a draft works, that's good, right, first. And second, you start regularly. I think I wrote this down, last year in 2022, you had 22 appearances and started 21 times.
Yeah.
So you are a starter who is very good at your sport. So these are, and we've already established that you will work your fingers to the bone, right? So these feel like things that could really happen. So what's the end, right? And you're only 24. You can play for a really long time, right? And who knows if, I doubt there are many Tom Brady's who play till 45 in professional soccer, right? But what's is there ever a moment where you're like, yeah, I've done it all. I'll be done.
I don't know, because there's a lot that I want to accomplish. So obviously I've mentioned stuff for the national team, which I'm still on the outside looking in. You know, they just played a game the other day against Serbia, and I'm here, I'm not there. So I'm still on the outside looking in, trying to work towards being there whenever there's an opportunity.
Is that hard or is that motivating?
It's both.
It's both.
It's both. Because, like, part of me, you know, knows I can do better. And then there's also a part of me thinking, like, maybe you could be there right now, you know? So it's both. But definitely motivating. But I'm also happy that I have teammates there. You know, DeJuan Jones, teammate of mine with the Revs, is there. And I'm really happy for him. Got his first appearance. So congrats to him. But yeah, it's both. And then in terms of club soccer, there's a lot that I want to accomplish too. I want to win MLS Cup with the Revs. There are different leagues that I want to play in. You know, MLS it's different than these other sports where it's clear that the U.S. is the pinnacle of the sport. That's not necessarily the case here. So I want to play in Europe. I want to play in different countries, have different experiences, and you only have so much time to do it. So
it's a busy agenda.
It's a busy agenda. There's a lot I need to get to and not a lot of time.
All right, one more trivia question.
Okay.
Because I just want to know. So when the articles reported on you playing for the U.S. team, they said something about you're wearing the cap. What does that mean?
Okay. Yeah. Let me explain. So I think it goes back a long time to history/tradition, where when you got an appearance for your national team, you received a cap. You received a physical cap. Now it's just a term.
Okay, so no one gives you a hat.
Yeah, no one gives me a hat.
God, it kind of seems like they could afford to give you a hat.
Yeah, I kind of want a hat,
yeah.
You know, now that you say it. But no, so it's just called – so instead of an appearance, it's literally called a cap for the national team.
Got it.
So I have two caps because I've played two games for the U.S.
You have two caps and you have zero caps.
And I have zero caps,
yeah. Okay. All right, so last thing. I want to pick a little bit of a fight here, Henry. You're from New York.
Yeah.
And you're in Boston. And yeah, I wish listeners could see the look on your face right now. It's like I don't even have to finish the question. So are you, you know, learning to love the Boston? I'm sure you love the Revolution, and I'm not going to ask you to say anything else, right? But are you learning to love the Boston teams, or are you just disguising your New York passion?
It's a bit of both. It's a bit of both. So the Celtics recently hosted me at a game. So
how did that feel?
It felt great. And so I sat second row. You know, I felt like a high roller. So I was really excited. They played the Warriors too, so it was a great game. You know, overtime win. So I was very thankful
well,
to be there.
That was a good game.
A fantastic game,
yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So I was very thankful that you know I got to go to that game. I've been to several Red Sox games, and that's the team I cannot root for. That is the team. So I grew
Are
up.
Are you Yankees or
I'm
Mets?
A Yankees fan.
You're, oh,
I'm
dude.
A Yankees fan.
Out. Go. Where this interview is done. We're done.
And that's the one team I can't get behind. So the Pats, we share a stadium. You know, I've met some of them.
Yeah.
All great guys. So I'm rooting for them too. I'm not huge on football, but you know, I've kind of adopted the Pats. Celtics hosted me, as I said. Bruins, I would love to get to a game. Haven't been to a game yet, so I'm hoping to do that. This would be the year. They're doing great, right?
Yep.
But no, the Red Sox, that's the one team I cannot root for. Yeah, and it's
tough.
Well,
in all fairness, right now there are a lot of Red Sox fans themselves who are feeling that way. So we'll just leave it at that. Henry Kessler is a defensive player. He's a center back for the New England Revolution. What a delight. Thank you for coming in. So nice to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me. Nice to meet you as well.
Good luck with the season.
Thank you.
That was New England Revolution defender Henry Kessler from a conversation we had with him in February of this year. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Amanda Beland and Rob Lane with Bart Tachi and John Bender. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director with help from Renee Marchando. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.